You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Elizabeth Colbert's new book on global warming draws heavily on interviews she did with leading climate scientists. Here's what two of them had to say. David Rind with NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies told her, quote, "I wouldn't be shocked to find out that by 2100, most things were destroyed," unquote. Marty Hofford, a physicist at New York University, told Colbert, quote, "Right now we're going to just burn everything up. We're going to heat the atmosphere to the temperature it was in the Cretaceous when there were crocodiles at the poles, and then everything will collapse," unquote. These comments, many others, and a great deal of additional information and insight are stuffed into Elizabeth Colbert's new book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Colbert has been a staff writer for The New Yorker since 1999. She joins us now by phone from Massachusetts, where she lives. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. The word catastrophe in your book's title, it's a strong word. Is it your word?
Well, you often hear, you know, people speaking, unfortunately, nowadays about an impending climate catastrophe. I certainly wouldn't say it's original to me in any way. I definitely chose it to, shock people out of, you know, what I think is a somewhat unfortunate complacency that this country seems to have towards an issue that really demands precisely the reverse.
Well, we keep hearing things about such and such a year being the hottest on record and so on. To what extent has that been true in recent years?
Oh, it's been completely true. I mean, you know, it hasn't set a record every single year, but if you look at what are the top five hottest years on record, they all basically have occurred since 1998. And last year, 1998 was an El Nino year. It was a very warm year. By some accounts, it's still the hottest year on record. But by most accounts, 2005 was really in a statistical tie with 2005, 2002, 2003, 2004. Those were all very warm years. And this is, you know, not a coincidence.
What could be said about the atmosphere's warmth compared to, you know, the last couple millennia, the last couple hundred thousand years, that kind of time frame?
Well, we have very good data that we're as hot as we are since the instrumental record began, which is around the Civil War. Then when you go farther back than that, you're dealing with what scientists call proxy data. So that is things that measure temperature but not directly, ice core records, things like that. And that is where you get into what's the famous hockey stick curve, which shows that we are now significantly warmer than we've been at any point in the last 1,000 years. The temperatures have risen very steeply in recent years. They had been relatively constant for the last 1,000 years. That graph was recently, just basically last week, a federal panel came to the conclusion that although there's been sort of a lot of noise around that, actually it was quite accurate as we are likely to get. That was a legitimate conclusion to reach, that we are now, you know, warmer than we've been for the last 1,000 years. Now, when you go back much farther than that, you're relying on ice core data. And once again, that's pretty good data. And we have reason to believe, you know, that we're now just about as warm as we have been in any time for the last several hundred thousand years. There have probably been moments when it's been slightly warmer, but not a whole lot. And I should point out that at those moments, too, sea level was probably significantly higher than it is right now. Now we are heading into territory, if we continue on the path that we're on, that we probably have not seen in several million years.
Now, all of this relates to carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And as I understand it, they work in that these gases go up into the atmosphere, and while they let all of the sun's radiation in, the incoming heat in, they partly block the radiation that the Earth emits outward. Is that basically true? And if so, by how much have carbon dioxide emissions increased over time?
That's a very good explanation of global warming. As you point out, the atmosphere is basically transparent in the visible part of the spectrum. So the sun's rays come through the atmosphere, and then what greenhouse gases do is they trap the heat energy that the Earth is always radiating out back towards space. They trap some of it. We have very good data about what the atmosphere has looked at like over the last several hundred thousand years from ice cores drilled in Antarctica, which contain, you know, these little tiny bubbles of trapped air that are actually a sample of the atmosphere from that time. And what we know is that CO2 levels are roughly 35% higher right now than they have ever been for the last several hundred thousand years. Mm. Methane, which is an even stronger greenhouse gas, it's a less prevalent greenhouse gas, but it's a stronger greenhouse gas, is double what it has ever been. So those are the two big ones. Now, I should also add that water vapor is a greenhouse gas, and as you raise the temperature, as everybody knows, you know, warm air can hold more moisture. So you're also increasing the amount of water vapor in the air, and that also has a big effect on the climate.
Right. This is one of those feedback mechanisms you point to in your book, which is about how even small changes can become enlarged, become magnified by feedback loops like this, whereby, and you just mentioned, in water vapor, with the warmer air, it holds more water, and then that water vapor in turn becomes a greenhouse gas. So that's an argument, I guess, for making sure that even small steps in a certain direction don't go too far.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that the climate, once you start to head it in one direction, there are these feedback loops that take, you know, relatively small changes and nudge them up, ramp them up, amplify them. And one is, as you say, is the effect that I just mentioned, which is that warmer, you know, air holds more water vapor, and that helps to increase the temperature. Another positive feedback, so there are positive feedbacks and negative feedbacks, and unfortunately the positive feedbacks seem to outweigh the negative feedbacks. Another positive feedback, which you often hear people talking about nowadays, is called, you know, is the ice albedo feedback, it's called. And what this is ice reflects sunlight, especially sea ice, which is very clean and very white. So it reflects most of the light that hits it. It just reflects that right, like a mirror, right back out to space. And as you start melting that ice, which we are doing, we are melting the Arctic ice cap, water is very dark, as everyone knows, and it absorbs that heat. So it absorbs that heat, you get more melt, you get more heat absorption. So basically you're changing the whole energy budget of the planet. You're no longer reflecting that light into space, you're absorbing it. And that is also has a big feedback.
So that suggests that even if the climate change in the direction of hotter were stopped right now, the process put in motion, for example, by this ice albedo feedback would continue?
Well, I think, you know, to be frank about it, everyone would tell you there's a lot of change left in the system. So even if you were to hold greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere constant, you would still be warming the planet. Yes, you're absolutely right. For the next several decades, we would. I think the thing that people have to be aware of, though, is that there's a real concern, and there's very good evidence that there are these, you know, thresholds in the system where you start setting in motion things that are really calamitous. For example, melting the Greenland ice sheet, melting the West Antarctic ice sheet, and then you get these tremendous sea level rise. And what we are talking about now is really trying to avoid crossing that threshold. And really, it's hard to imagine anything, you know, that could be more important for the planet than doing that.
Elizabeth Colbert joins us by phone on Against the Grain. She is author of The Prophet of Love and Other Tales of Power and Deceit. We're talking about her latest book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, just out from Bloomsbury. She's been a staff writer for The New Yorker since 1999, and she wrote a series for The New Yorker, which won the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences Award for Magazine Writing. Wow, that's a mouthful. and on the basis of that New Yorker series, she wrote this book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe. And we have a link to Field Notes from a Catastrophe on our website, againstthegrain.org. My name is C.S. Song. Well, we hear about atmospheric concentrations of carbon and carbon dioxide, and Let me see. Back in 1959, a guy named Charles David Keeling, a U.S. chemist, he began measuring atmospheric CO2 or providing the equipment to measure it. And it was at 316 parts per million. And it has gone up ever since. And in 2005, last year, it was at 378 parts per million. What atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide represents the point of no return, or do we know that yet?
Well, you've really gotten to the heart of the matter. We don't know that, and the tragic thing is when we know for sure, it will doubtless be too late because of this sort of lag in the system that we've been talking about. It takes a long time for changes set in motion to sort of work their way through the whole climate system, and that has a bunch of reasons, one of them being that the oceans have to heat up, and that, as anyone who's ever, boiled a pot of water knows, that's a slow process. So it's very hard to say exactly what that level is. You often hear people talking about 450 or 500 ppm parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere as being a threshold that you don't want to cross. Now, I should point out that when I wrote the book, I used the latest figures, and it was at 378. This past year, CO2 took a near record jump of almost 3 parts per million. So we're now up at 381, and really, to be honest, we're probably beyond 381 by now. So we are rapidly approaching, the 450 mark and heading right on to the 500 mark. And as many people point out, if we don't do something, we're just going to continue. We're just going to basically ramp right through that 500 and keep on going. Now, 500 is roughly twice the concentration of CO2 that existed before industrialization. And most scientists, I believe there's a very robust consensus, would say that is a very, very dangerous level to pass.
And when might we pass that level? And I know that depends on what we do now and what we do a decade from now, but what are the best and worst estimates for that?
Right. Well, if we just sort of continue on our merry way, we will, without pretty dramatic changes in how we use and consume energy, make and consume energy, we will doubtless hit 500 by the middle of this century.
And what does that mean for, say, temperature rises over the next 50 years and over the next 100 years?
Well, what scientists do is when they calculate the temperature increase associated with a certain level of CO2, they do what's called an equilibrium model run. So they run this through the model, and they wait till the climate reaches a new equilibrium, because as I mentioned before, it takes a while for the climate to respond. So let's say by the end of this century, if you get doubled CO2, so around 500, 550 parts per million, you're looking at a temperature increase of and there's a range because there are different models get different results, between, let's say, 4 and 7.5 degrees, let's say, although there are also recent results that suggest it could be much higher. There also is evidence some people would say that it could actually happen much faster. So the climate is a huge and immense system, and there are many things that we don't understand, and the things that we don't understand are often used to justify inaction. But I would argue, and I think most climate scientists would argue, that uncertainty is precisely the wrong argument for inaction. Uncertainty is the reason for action, because uncertainty cuts both ways. You can say that this will happen, at a higher level and later than you think, but it is just as likely, and the evidence suggests it's more likely to happen sooner and to be worse than we calculated.
Let's talk about ice, and specifically ice in glaciers. You spent some time at a research camp called Swiss Camp, which is built right on top of the Greenland ice sheet. And I didn't know that Greenland is almost 4 times the size of France. That's a huge country. Tell us about Swiss Camp.
Yeah, well, Greenland is just an amazing, amazing place, sort of beyond imagination, practically. And Swiss Camp is just a set of tents, really, that were built in sort of drilled into the ice sheet on a platform on the ice sheet. And some of it's now sort of become unusable over time, because what happens is it gets buried in snow, and then there's a big melt in the summer, and so the places, when you arrive there, the place has just been filled with ice, and everything is sort of in this huge cakes of blocks of ice. So people don't sleep inside anymore because the sleeping quarters kind of get wrecked by this. So everyone sleeps outside in tents. So it's a very primitive place, I have to say, but a great place and a spectacular place. And you can't see anything really in any direction except this expanse of white. It's just a remarkable sight.
And so the researchers there exist to do what, and why is the Greenland ice sheet such an important subject for study, object for study?
Right. Well, it's actually a really interesting story. When they went up there, they were interested in, you know, the ice sheet. The ice sheet is just an astonishing place. It's sort of a remnant of the last ice age, and it has, you know, at its thickest, it has 2 miles of ice, and there's just... It's just a tremendously fascinating place, and they went there to just look at meteorological conditions. And then as time went on, you know, people started to notice these huge effects that are the effects of warming temperatures. So it's become much more focused on the effects of warming, and many, many more people go up there now because Greenland is such a concern. And why is Greenland a concern? Well, Greenland is a concern because the ice sheet on Greenland, which, as I said, is 2 miles thick at a certain point, contains like 8% of the world's fresh water, enough water to raise global sea levels by roughly 20 feet, would not form under current climate conditions. And it is literally left over from the last ice age. And it is kept, you know, sort of alive, if that's the right word, by the fact that it's so high and it's so cold up at the top of the ice sheet. Now, you start changing that, you start melting it, and there is it's absolutely indisputable that more of the surface of Greenland has meltwater on it every summer, then you can potentially melt down that ice sheet. And that process might take a long time. It might take hundreds of years. But once you set it in motion, it's very, very hard to think of how you could stop it, because you have basically started to bring that ice sheet into, you know, the modern world, and it won't reform. It will just simply continue to melt.
Right, and there's also, and you're referring to this, I guess, some sort of feedback mechanism too, right, that somehow the melting, once it begins to melt, there are processes set in motion that make it continue to melt?
Yes, exactly. What has been discovered, and much of this was discovered at Swiss Camp, is that this water, you get this surface melt at the top of the ice sheet, really just basically huge puddles. And what seems to be happening is that this water works its way all the way down to the bottom of the ice sheet, thousands of feet below. And we can tell that by the fact that in the summer, the ice sheet sort of raises up on this sort of cushion of water. We can tell that from GPS measurements. And their belief right now is that that tends to sort of lubricate the thing, and it starts moving faster. You have to understand that ice is always moving. Glaciers are always flowing. They flow basically like water, only much, much more slowly. But there's very good data now that all of these huge ice streams on Greenland are speeding up. And as they speed up, they discharge more and more icebergs into the North Atlantic, and that basically means they're just losing mass. So Greenland is now starting to lose mass to the oceans, and that is contributing to sea level rise already.
Okay, so you said that, let's see, this ice sheet, the Greenland ice sheet, contains 8% of the world's freshwater supplies. That's just a staggering statistic, as well as the fact that this ice sheet currently covers over 80% of Greenland. You know, okay, so this process is in motion. It's beginning to melt. It's beginning to move faster. What do we know? And you also said earlier that if it melts completely, that global sea levels will rise around 20 feet. Is it just a matter of time before it melts completely? And when might that happen?
Well, I don't think anyone knows that. I think it adds a tremendous amount of urgency to what we're doing. I think that the evidence, you know, is increasingly frightening, to be honest, and I think that most of the scientists on Greenland think the evidence is increasingly frightening. But I don't think anyone would say we know that. We only have, you know, a decade or so of good satellite measurements and things like that. But if current trends continue, I think there's a pretty good consensus that, yes, we will have set the eventual destruction of the Greenland ice sheet in motion. How long will that entire process take? Once again, very hard to answer. I believe people used to think it would be on the order of millennia, but now, because of the speed at which they're seeing some of the changes, the speed at which the ice sheet is speeding up, people would say it's a matter of centuries.
Yeah, what should this kind of information do to many people's beliefs that, you know, change happens slowly, gradually, kind of incrementally?
Yeah, that that I think is a relic of the fact that we have tended to live in a climatically very stable time, and I don't think that that's a coincidence. You know, I mean, if you look at the climate record, one of the really fascinating things about Greenland is this long climate record going back to the beginning of the last ice age about more than 100,000 years ago, and it shows that the climate has flipped back and forth and back and forth over the years, even as the world was in an ice age. And when you think about our ancestors on this planet and how they were nomadic, and a lot of those, you know, movements were probably driven by these really pretty traumatic climate shifts. And then if you start to look at the last 8,000 or 7,000 or 8,000 years, when all of human civilization, you know, emerged, you see that the climate was unusually stable for that period of time. And one of the things that scientists have discovered by looking at the Greenland ice sheet is that the climate can change very, very fast. So our notion that things stay the same, you know, is based on this anomalous experience that humans have had up till now. Unfortunately, it ain't necessarily so.
Elizabeth Colbert with a K, K-O-L-B-E-R-T, joining us. She's author most recently of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, just out from Bloomsbury. She was a reporter for the New York Times for 14 years, and she's been a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine since 1999. We have a link to her latest book on our website, againstthegrain.org. And before we leave the question of ice, what about sea ice in the Arctic? Is that melting at a significant rate? And what happens when sea ice melts?
Yes, the Arctic sea ice is melting at a very significant rate. And there is even more concern in a certain sense over the fate of the Arctic ice cap. If you look at trends, they're very clear. They're very sharply downward. Just this past year was a record melt year, so the sea ice retreats in the summer. It melts, and at the end of September, they sort of look at the minimum extent of the ice sheet, and in September 2005, the ice sheet was the smallest it has been since record-keeping began. And then over the winter, when there's no sun at all, you know, up on the North Pole, the ice sheet starts to grow again. And then this April, when they took the extent of the winter ice sheet, it was once again the smallest that it had ever been. So it didn't really recover. It grew, but it didn't grow as much as it normally does. So you are looking at very sharply downward trends. And there is a fairly good degree of consensus that we could, once again, if current trends continue, have no Arctic sea ice in the summertime by the middle of this century. And that is just an incredible thing. The Arctic has probably been not been ice-free for millions and millions of years. And the implications of that are hard to know. I mean, it's such a huge change that we don't know exactly how that will play out. But sea ice has a somewhat different effect from land-based ice. Land-based ice, when it melts, it contributes directly to sea level rise. But sea ice, since it's already floating, does not contribute very much is sea level rise. So it's not a sea level rise issue, but it is, as I think I mentioned before, it's a heat budget of the planet problem. You're just taking that energy that used to be re-radiated, reflected back into space, and you're absorbing it. So you're just absorbing more and more heat on Earth.
Right. As you referred to earlier, ice is a wonderful reflector, or ice covered by snow is a wonderful reflector of the sun's radiant heat. But then when that melts, then you have dark water, and that is the worst reflector. And so more open water equals more sunlight heating the ocean. Elizabeth Colbert, author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, a very interesting, very provocative, somewhat alarming book. And we are going to talk more with her about both the environmental issues around global warming and the political issues after this music break. Please stay with us.